Stupid studio being stupid.
I'm Austin.
And I'm Cloud.
And this is We Watch Movies.
Today's movie is The Poseidon Adventure. Poseidon Adventure is a 1972 action-adventure drama disaster movie film. Produced by Irwin Allen, directed by Ronald Namey, starring Gene Hackman, Ernest Borgnine, Red Buttons, Carol Lindley, Shelley Winters, Roddy McDowell, Stella Stevens, Jack Albertson, Pamela Sue Martin, Arthur O'Connell, Eric Shea, and Leslie Nielsen. That was a lot of synopsis.
The ship, known as Poseidon, is on a voyage to, are they going to Italy or are they going to Israel? Like, because you have all these people going to different locations, but they're going somewhere over in that area. And they get toppled over by a very, very large wave. So a select group of people who chose to move instead of staying in one place kind of survive as they trail through a destroyed and burning ship.
And upside down. Which is kind of the important part. Like, wrecked and burning, you expect. Upside down is the thing that makes it a little bit more of a special case.
Like, we kind of knew the ship. Now we have no idea.
No. And all of the things that aren't made of solid metal are down.
Yeah.
Now.
I want to know why everyone seems to be so afraid of water. Like, I know the ship is sinking, but it's you have the people who chose not to go, and then that's when it starts flooding, and then they panic. Can no one swim?
Well, I think they just realized that they made a mistake. And if they, it's just blind panic. They're not even thinking like, oh, the water's coming in. We're all going to die, you know.
Death by water.
And so they just, everybody freaks out and gets everybody killed. Which, the people who were wrong get killed. All of them.
All of them.
And they stay that way and they don't cause any trouble for anyone else.
Yep.
And there are a couple of other times where there are things that you could go the other way on that would screw it up that they didn't, because they know the kind of thing that they're making, even though this is fairly early on.
No waterlogged ship zombies, none of that. Like,
no, well, I mean,
they're dead. Well, it's over. We don't have to deal with it. Moving on.
Even without the zombies, like, if this was Train to Busan instead of Poseidon Adventure, we thought he was dead and he's really wet now. Purser would like come. He would have been waiting for them in the rescue helicopter and he would have like flown it off and left them there and then like crashed into the ocean. Like, that's what would have happened. And it would have been super bogus, just as it was. There's a time or two where I think, Jewish swimming wife dying might be like what comes after it, and then the dealing with the emotion of that works, I think. But just killing her in just sort of nothing really happened, she's just fat, so she had a convenient heart attack right now.
See,
so
that's what I was wondering about.
Feels a little like, oh, well, it's been a while since we killed a main character, it's time, so it doesn't feel as natural as some of the others. Even as natural as Gene Hackman's just a few minutes later.
Yeah. Well, that was... okay, so the lady dying of a heart attack, I wasn't even sure what she was dying from.
Well, they don't say, but I mean, she kind of like grabs at her chest and
barely,
there's pain. And, yeah, it's the only thing that... it's the only obvious thing that it might be. It's either a heart attack or a stroke, and it doesn't look like a stroke. So
her diabetes kicked in or something.
And they talked so much about, well, with the way that, according to some recent movies that we've watched, the way that that the diabetes is, maybe. But they've leaned so much on her being fat, or at least thinking that she's fat, or she is fat, but maybe she thinks she's more fat than she actually is, but she's still fat, so fat people have heart attacks.
Well, no, see, I don't think that's fair, though. I don't think that's fair to just say, oh, well, she's fat, and so we're going to make comments about her being fat, and then she conveniently has a heart attack. Like, if they would have said something prior, like she's taking medicine to help prevent one because she's had one in the past, something to let us know that she does have a condition that she has to be careful of.
Well, I don't know. I think that might be a little too lampshady, where if you have the heart attack medicine early in the movie, then now you just Chekhov-gun the heart attack. Like, she's going to have a heart attack, or she's going to almost have a heart attack, and they're not going to know where the medicine is. Or
well,
you're
going to
know something is going to come from this, because nothing in the first third or quarter of a disaster movie is nothing.
Yeah. Well, see, that's
it's
the thing.
It's
like
character setup.
Well, that's why it's okay. It's because, one, this movie is... diabetes. It is one of the older movies, so it's not a trope yet. You know, it's something that they could have had. But at the same time, like, the lonely guy that does all the jogging in the morning, and he has, like, this whole slew of pills.
Yeah.
And, like, that doesn't come to anything other than, isn't vitamin E supposed to give you a hard-on?
Which I've never heard.
Yeah, I've never heard
that either. That's the rumor. I'm like, I've never heard that. Like, there's lots of things that vitamin E is for.
That rumor didn't last.
No, well, because I guess it was totally bogus, or the movie made it up. I'm not sure which. But, well, you say it's not a trope, but it's interesting to, like, you think that being that all that there had really been before this was the first airport movie and maybe, like, one other thing. But the two other major ones that we think of, Earthquake and Towering Inferno, were both in 74, which is 2 years after this. And the other airport movies, and then I think there's one called Roller Coaster, which I've never seen. And, you know, the 70s disaster movie was kind of a thing. But if you read Roger Ebert's review from the time, he acts as if it already is a trope. He's like, well, we're going to expect some things here, and then here's the thing, and here's the thing, and here's the thing. So even though he's writing in 72, he's still already like, well, there's some things to expect, and here they are, and we got them. And so it seems as if it may be a little more tropey in its time than it would have seemed like looking back on it, because it is early and it's in the time.
But see, that's the thing. There's just, it's too early. It's too early to, like, it's like, oh yeah, like, this is the third one out of, like, six that we're going to make this year. And this is, I feel like now, definitely.
Well,
like,
I think
there's no way around
it. Not in a disaster movie, just in a movie, like, you introduce heart attack medicine, that's probably coming back in some way.
Well, see, you don't even have to say it's heart attack medicine.
Well,
it doesn't, because that's the thing. It's like,
how are we gonna know?
Well, here's the deal: you have grandpa tell grandma to remember to take your daily medicine, because the doctor, like, and you can have, like, the scientific name or whatever for the heart doctor, because I'm not sure what they're
the
called.
Cardiologist.
Yeah, the cardiologist gave you the medicine. You make sure you take it. And it's like, okay,
well, we do have
the ship's
doctor going around handing out seasickness stuff, and he's sort of wasted on a scene.
Yeah.
with Ernest Borgnine and his wife. But it's not food poisoning.
It's not food poisoning. It's not food poisoning. It's not.
It's not. Brittany watched this with us. She said, when it's food poisoning,
you know. Yeah.
So, yes, which is true. I did want to point out, in case you didn't notice, we almost never point out episode numbers, but this is episode 178. It's a little hard not to know. Like, we kind of have we have some splaining to do, because
177 was really, really, really
yeah,
long.
177
30-ish parts.
32 parts, because there's also 177.x, which is like the 15 minutes of outtakes thing. So all of October is 177 point something. So this is 178. And if you go back and look at episode 78, that's the Towering Inferno. And so we decided some time ago that every episode that ends in a 78, so every 100 episodes you'll get one of these, we'll do one of the big 70s disaster movies. And now you might say, but what about the Hindenburg? Well, the Hindenburg isn't a disaster movie. Some people think it is. Some people confuse it is. We discussed that on that episode. Some critics complained that it wasn't disastery enough, despite being a disaster movie, somewhat unfairly because it doesn't present itself that way. It's just a drama that has a mystery that has a disaster at the end. But it's not a disaster movie. You have to have the disaster in like the first third and then dealing with surviving through the aftermath for it to be a disaster movie.
But oh, the huge manatee.
Well, that be that as it may. So that doesn't, I don't remember what episode number that was, but it doesn't, I think it's like 99. I think it's like right before episode 100. But so it's a different thing. And we're kind of going, we're going backwards in time, but we're still doing one of the, you might have also noticed that I mentioned produced by Irwin Allen and then stumbled over the rest of it because I'm not used to doing that. Because this is Irwin Allen's production of The Poseidon Adventure, which they also did with The Towering Inferno, and you would see sometimes in the 70s, even without it being Irwin Allen, when it was something that was based on a very popular book that had come out fairly recently before. The book of this came out in 69 and the movie came out in 72. So it was very, very close together. And so it's almost like they're treating it like the book is, they're almost calling back to like theater kinds of things where this is a book. We didn't create this. We're just making this production of it. Someone else could do it. That would be their production of it. Which you don't get anymore. Now the studio buys up a book and then they make it and now we own it for the next 75 years. And it's a little different now. And sometimes you didn't get it. You know, it doesn't say, well, I guess maybe you do because, well, no, you don't. Okay, no, they don't say it. I didn't think they did, but you don't get Albert Ruddy's production of The Godfather, even though that was very, very close together in time and was a hugely popular thing that just got an ordinary studio presents thing. But Irwin Allen, which we think of now as just sort of like the guy, he in a way is sort of important as a producer in the way that Jerry Bruckheimer is or Joel Silver is, where like you see Jerry Bruckheimer as the producer or the executive producer on a movie and you think, okay, I know what kind of movie this is going to be. It's going to be big and action-y and high budget and extreme and things that somebody else wouldn't do. You know, he looked at Top Gun and was like, if we're going to make Top Gun, we have to shoot this at like 10,000 feet in the air, like all the cockpit stuff, because otherwise it won't be as exciting as it could be. And those are the kinds of things where that's what makes a Jerry Bruckheimer action movie what it is just he has these ideas about things. And
so we're going to rant about the ship.
Well,
and then we're not going to tell the studio about it. We're just going to flip it over.
Well, they didn't do that because the other thing about these Irwin Allen big 70s disaster movies and just big movies in general, everything has to be done in some physical manner. And so you get a lot of big models and great sets and in some cases matte paintings. There isn't really very much matte painting in this.
Yeah, I didn't notice any.
There might not be any.
Yeah, I didn't know of any at
specifically.
Because normally, like, they have a very specific type of distance between them. Like, you can tell, like, oh, well, like, there's just, it's a very odd distance between the local environment, the actor, and then what seems like the background. And so unless they had matte paintings that they had focused really closely to the actors, like that's the only thing I could think of, but there wasn't a scene that really directly needed any kind of large painted environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're never outside, really. I guess there could have been something really early, like in the storm, because that's the only time we're on the deck of the ship at like where we can see at a distance, because when we have the ship in floating in the ocean, we always look at it from a fairly high angle. And so we're looking down, we can't see the horizon. That is a model. That's like a 20 something foot long model of the ship that had actual working lights and propellers and everything. And they didn't so that we get another. It's not quite the same kind of scale, although we still get that with the sets, as the actual, like, we built five stories of the Towering Inferno building, like, full size, at, like, way up in the air, so we could hang off of the penthouse thing. And so, but it is a really big model of the ship. Now, they did use an actual ship. They used the Queen Mary, which is old and docked in New Jersey or somewhere, isn't it?
Well, I figured they would have used it for, like,
they used that for the outside stuff on the deck and a lot of the interior stuff before, except for the ballroom or the dining room before it's flipped over. Like their quarters when the doctor comes up and when people are just walking around the ship, I think the bridge, at least some of the time, maybe that's always a set because they have to destroy it. But then once the wave hits,
they didn't have to destroy it because we never go back into it after the wave.
Well, no, but the wave comes in and like it floods with water. We do see it flood. So that probably wasn't the real bridge of the actual Queen Mary. But because we never go back there. But all of the rest of it after that is all sets. And the dining room is actually the same set. That's the only one that's the same before and after. All of the others were built upside down to start with. But because that was such a large space and they couldn't do that twice and build it both ways, they built it the first time in such a way that they could take pieces off of it, move things around, and make it upside down without doing much actual change to it. And it's the same room. And they actually built it like up slightly off the ground and used big forklifts to lift it up at an angle. Like a really steep angle, like 30 degrees or something, when the wave is hitting and the ship is turning over, but it's not there yet, and everybody's sliding down the deck. Like, that is actually people sliding down the actual floor of the actual full-scale set that's being lifted up by big forklifts.
Okay, so I want to talk about that scene for a minute, because I hated that scene. I hated that scene, not because I didn't think it looked good, because it does look good. I hated it because the people were being stupid, and they're causing themselves more issues than they should have. Like, the only person I feel for was the guy who was smashed by that piano.
Uh-huh.
Like, he was in the clear, and that piano just ramrods him, just, and he's dead. Death by piano.
What, it won't play?
I gotta reset. You can continue talking.
Lord. But everybody's like just trying so hard to stay in place.
Yeah, instead of just sliding down the floor as it goes before it gets steep.
Yeah, and because then you have like the daughter or whatever, the girl with her brother, and she's on the table that's attached to the ceiling now. And it's just like, if you would have just went with it, you wouldn't have had a single issue. Yeah, there's some debris kind of floating around, but that'll be fine. You know, a plate of food landing on your clothes isn't going to be an issue because the ship is turning upside down. I think that's a bit more important.
Yeah. It would seem so.
And when they finally get it done and they're like trying to formulate a plan, and you have the preacher guy saying like everybody's long skirts are going to have to like come off. I don't know like how far ahead they actually thought of this because they use so few characters to deal with it. Because you notice that the grandma, like, she didn't take hers off, obviously.
No.
Because she was still wearing like her whole thing.
Hers wasn't tight though.
Yeah. But then you like have like
Chloe, because he said you can't climb in a tight dress or a tight skirt. And so I think that was the problem with the sister and with Ernest Borgnine's wife,
the ex-hooker.
Ooh. Yeah.
I'm not sugarcoating it. That's what she was.
She was.
All right. And so like for the sister, she's just already ready. It's just like, oh, yeah, it's just here. Let me just unfasten this. Bam. Now they're shorts.
I have these shorts that match the dress.
Yeah. And it's just like, OK, well, that's super convenient. And I think we had to have that just so they could have the, I'm going to throw a fit because my wife's not wearing anything underneath it other than underwear. And I'm thinking, well, that's kind of a common thing that you do. You're not supposed to be wearing like a full plate suit of armor underneath a fucking dress.
Yeah, because
like,
it's a dress.
Yeah, it's a
like,
dress.
The dress is like, it's one whole thing. Like you put the dress on, that's what you're wearing now. So.
Yeah, and I kind of thought she wasn't going to have anything because she was an ex-hooker. You know, they always seem to have this type of persona attached to her where it's like, I'm embarrassed because I was a hooker and I still kind of act like a hooker. And my husband is the cop that got me off the streets.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm completely naked in bed when the doctor shows up and it's just like, it's just seasickness. And it's, but I am wearing underwear underneath this dress and I have to take the whole dress off. So now I got to wear this coat.
Shirt.
Oh.
She takes his shirt. It's his pink shirt.
Yeah. Was it pink?
It was pink. It was a light pink. Yep.
Okay.
Because we also have to get Ernest Borgnine into his I'm in peril and having an adventure t-shirt. So we can't. He still has his suspenders, doesn't he?
I don't think so. Shirt?
Maybe not. I thought for a moment when they're getting ready in their room to go to the dinner with the captain that he was wearing a belt and suspenders because his tuxedo pants have this like adjustable thing that you can like tie at the back. And it looked like a part of a belt, but then there wasn't anything on the front. So I was like, okay, so he's not wearing a belt and suspenders. Because if a character in this movie is going to be wearing a belt and suspenders, it's the lonely guy.
Yeah.
It is ridiculous power walking or whatever it is that he's doing.
Every morning, like clockwork.
Yeah.
Now, that scene where the cop and ex-hooker are like communicating and the
are they communicating?
Yes.
And they're doing a lot of shouting.
They are communicating. And I think it's kind of funny because I feel bad for him and then I don't feel bad for him all at the same time because he's speaking, as I would call it, firmly. He is speaking firmly. He has like I don't want to say he's yelling, but he is louder.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she's on the other side of the door, you can hear him talking louder after that point. And I can understand that because he's having to talk to her through the door, even though she could have heard him perfectly fine. And then she tells him to stop yelling and he starts talking in a more reasonable fashion. And then she yells at him.
Yeah.
Like that was really funny. I didn't expect it. So that was really funny. And then it's like you get that aw kind of moment. Where it's like I was sleeping with all these dudes. And he's like, but I don't care. I still love you. And then it's just like, aw. That's why he kept arresting her. So at least we had some decent character development. It wasn't just like a blind character kind of like, oh, we got this person's well known. We'll cast
token blind character.
Yeah, like we'll just cast him here and then we'll use him, but we're not gonna give him anything to do, really. Like I like how they handled these characters.
Well, that is one of the things that became a thing about these movies was that they're big ensemble movies. There's a bunch of characters, and usually almost all of them were well-known people. Which I guess is something that the first Airport movie kind of started because it has lots of people in it. And then like they continued on. They did get lazy a little bit later. Where like sometimes you even have well-known people playing their actual selves.
Yeah, that is kind of sloppy.
And so it's just like, hey, you're famous and you're in the movie as your famous person. So it's a little bit it's a little bit better when, yeah, you know who all these people are, but they're at least playing characters.
Yeah.
Now, there is much shouting, especially by Ernest Borgnine and Gene Hackman. And the director actually has said in interviews later that he felt maybe he kept the leash a little bit loose and let them do a bit too much scenery chewing, maybe, because they do... they do go really far some of the time. They're acting some of the time in a big way.
In quotations.
Acting. It's time for some acting now.
Well, I thought it worked fine until we got to Goro, which I believe was his name. The cop dude. I think that was his name, was Goro.
Rogo.
When Rogo does like that whole 180.
His wife dies.
No, I'm talking about like before that, whenever, because like he's really adamant about not following the preacher. Uh-huh. He doesn't like his attitude. He doesn't like being the follower. And then he's like, "All right, well, we'll just do his idea. We'll go with his plan." And he's like, "Oh, we really thought this was gonna be how it was." That's whenever they were doing the rope underwater.
Oh, okay.
Because it was that. Because it's like, you've been like against him this whole time, and now you're like right there. Like,
well,
it's a big flip.
He is so, his character is a little frustrating because he is so off and on, because he does follow along. He does believe him enough to not die in the dining room. He is just sort of default other capable guy, and so he does help him when things need to be done. They open the fire door together and stuff. But then. Off and on from that, then he's resistant to continuing to believe that he's right, and then just like either wants to give up or wants to go follow the people to the bow, even though the last time other people didn't listen, they didn't make it.
Well, see, I think this was acceptable because of his wife making him do it.
I guess so. I mean, that's okay.
Because, you know, like, she was going to do it because she was going to follow the preacher, and she's making her husband, who doesn't want to do it.
Which then he does make what seems like a real switch with the rope underwater thing.
Yeah.
And then I think that's what makes it so frustrating and plotty to have him flip the last time after his wife dies and then be all accusatory and take up their time that then gets them blocked by Steam that now Gene Hackman has to sacrifice for.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, no, wait. Like, everything you're saying is like, I know, like, you've been through a lot. It's rough. It's emotional. You're frustrated. You're angry. You're sad now because your wife is dead. But you're like, you killed her. It's like, well, no, he didn't. She kind of fell off the thing. Also, if you hadn't made it this far, you both would already have died in the dining room.
Yeah.
So nobody did any, you know, God killed her, maybe, if anybody is responsible, but nobody did anything. She fell off the side and she would have died way earlier if it wasn't for just the continuing on, which the preacher is largely responsible for.
His hand strength is amazing.
And then he does have to go. See, the thing is that there are these frustrating moments. There's the death of the Jewish wife. That is like, feels really gamey and bogus.
Yeah.
And then like great stuff comes after it. And then like you kind of forget, and or like things result directly of it that then are part of the format, and then things that we want to be there. And so then it kind of makes up for it, even though it was dumb in the moment. And then Ernest Borgnine does take back over because Gene Hackman is dead. And then everybody's like, he told you to get us through. You better do it. And then he's like, all right. And he steps up and he does it. And so then it's okay and we don't hate him anymore.
Well, no, see, that was the good thing is they insult his ability as a cop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you listen here now. You talked a lot of hot shit, but you're just a big wuss. And is this how you were as a cop? And that's when the guys are like, now, wait a second here. You're not gonna insult my badge. And then he gets it up and he gets it down. Now, one of the things I would have liked to have seen more of would be the kid that really, really likes the boat and wanted to learn. Because, like, we see him with, like, balls of steel. Like, it's just this huge storm. You can just see the boat all over the place. And this kid's just out there in his raincoat being like, yeah, no water's going to stop me. I'm getting to the bridge.
Mm-hmm. And that first scene is really great because he shows up and the captain is like, what are you doing here? And he's like, you said I could come visit the bridge whenever. And, like, I wanted to right now. And the captain's like,
I did say
yeah.
that.
I guess I have to.
You got me there.
Yeah.
Kid.
So
I just wanted him to play a bigger role because he's a very interesting character.
Yeah. I mean, he pipes up now and then with information, which then they insist on wanting to disbelieve, but then believe anyway and use.
No, see, that's the thing is there's only two references, two and a half maybe, that the kid ever does share. The first one is, I would say, the half part where it's like, oh, the metal is only 1 inch instead of 2 inch over here. The big part would be Broadway actually leading to a corridor for the boiler room.
Yeah, but what is his name? Carruthers or whatever. Oh, it's not his name.
Yeah.
But Akers also knows kind of that.
He knows that the Broadway will take him to the area that they need to go. He just wasn't sure if there was exits on it. Mm-hmm. So he gets him there and the kid's like, no, like we are going the right way. And then he talks about the propeller, the room that beam is in, mm-hmm. would be the best place to go to. And you'd have to go through this because one of the engineer guys showed him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, those are the two really big pieces of information. Outside of that, when we get him, it's like he's, like, apologizing because he called her fat
yeah.
indirectly.
Which,
and then it's like, hey, don't
like,
worry. Like, it makes him seem like he's a good kid.
Which they actually say you're a good kid to yeah. him.
But see, he is useful, and at no point in the movie would you actually say he's a hindrance. And that's what a lot of these movies that throw kids into them, like, the kid is a hindrance. They're a problem. They create a scene that, it's like, this scene is, it wouldn't be a scene if it wasn't for the kid being in trouble, stuff like that. Now, there was the, I gotta go to the John.
Which I thought was odd, because yeah. who says that, like, well, as kids?
Well, like,
especially the sister.
I didn't have
like, what a stupid thing to happen to die in the John. It's like, but it sounds weird hearing her say that.
But I'm okay with the scene in its entirety because we know that they're looking about for materials and we know he didn't go in there to use the restroom. He was just looking for stuff.
Yeah.
And that just happened to be when everything was going on.
Which then he doesn't make it back with his life jackets that he's carrying around
yeah.
because then everything's exploding and he just runs, but which they don't turn out to need anyway,
yeah.
but he was thinking.
He was thinking.
Yeah, because there are in what I guess they use a kid, one of the kids, as the like the hippie girl.
Nani?
On the like when she can't climb the ladder and she can't, well, actually they do it like two or three times. She can't swim, she can't climb the ladder.
You don't
She's
have
really
to
scared
swim
all the time.
You just have to hold your breath and pull on a rope.
but isn't there a moment in Towering Inferno where like the son or like the little boy has to jump across the thing and he's just like standing there while everything burns around them on the edge and he just can't do it?
I think so.
I seem to remember something like that.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
But it is interesting to see the we can't do this put onto the other grown-ups rather than the kids. Because
yeah.
the kids are always useful. He knows things. The sister is helping Gene Hackman find the hatch and lead the people. And
kind of. Because she follows him when she shouldn't have followed him because she was supposed to help get material. But at least she proved useful in it.
Yeah, but she scares him like really bad because he doesn't expect her to be there.
Bloody water zombies.
Now there are a bunch of like really large scale obvious emotional moments in this, and because it's, you know, the disaster movie is largely constructed of let's set up these characters so you'll care about them. Something disastrous happens. Some of the people who you already knew die, a few survive. A few of those will not survive to the end, and we'll get emotion out of that. And also, you know, triumph of spirit and getting things done and that those sorts of things. But, and so you have to have the, like, these big emotional things that are based on characters or wanting characters not to lose each other or something. But the one that I always forget about, except when it's recently after I've watched it, that's one of my favorite emotional moments in movies, is really small, and it probably just goes right by, and I don't know if anybody else even cares. But it's after they've, I think they're about halfway through the ship, and like several bad things have happened to them. And the older couple, which Jack Albertson plays the husband. She like the fat wife asks, they just sit down and everybody else kind of walks away for a minute. And he says, or she says to him, "Manny, do you still have your handkerchief?" And he kind of like, he feels around and he finds that he does still have his handkerchief, and he looks down at it, and he does this great, like, Jack Albertson, like, there's so much going on, and like there's so much humanness, like, in this, like, look on his face. He looks down and he says, and does this like half smile, and he says, "It's not very clean." And still, like, she kind of reaches it for it, and he offers it to her anyway, and she wipes her face with it. And just like, I don't know what exactly it is about that. I guess probably, like, I could go on for a while and dig through it and find and describe exactly what all of the emotional stuff is that's going on in there, but I won't do that. Just go and look at it.
It's because he has a handkerchief himself.
It's not that. It's not about the handkerchief. This isn't a, like, you should wear a belt because what if you accidentally sever a leg or someone else nearby does and you have to tourniquet that. It's not like that. It's not about the handkerchief. It's about the, like, well, I have this. I'm kind of ashamed that it's not really good enough for what you wanted. I guess you want it anyway, and I'm still kind of being able to help. And it's also because it wouldn't be the same if it was one of the other characters that asked for the handkerchief. It's, there's something in it about them as a, as an old married couple too, and it sort of builds on their, him not caring how long it's been since they've said "I love you" to each other, because they both know that they both still do, even if they haven't said it. And maybe they haven't said it because they both know that they both still do enough that they don't feel like they need to. And so they have this, they're much more of a married couple, I think, than Ernest Borgnine and Hooker wife are. I guess they're supposed to have been married for longer. So yeah, it makes sense that they have more of a deeper relationship. They seem to have only been married a couple of years or something, if that long even. And so they're still like early in their angry, fighty, like everything matters and we haven't just settled into being married yet. But there's just so much in that moment that just like it hits me super hard, and I just like, I couldn't not talk about it, at least for probably much too long a moment for anyone else to actually care. But go and look at that moment again and see if I'm just off the rails totally or what. Now, what do we think about Gene Hackman's Sweep Across?
I don't like it, but it didn't bother me to the point that when I saw him, all I saw was his hair.
Which it was like that for Bruce Willis.
Yes.
Just like,
you can't help but to look at him because it's that bloody hair.
Sweep across, sweep across, sweep across. I think there's a face under it. I'm not really sure. I can't look at it. I can't see anything but the sweep across. Yeah, this is the 70s, so there's some bananas clothes and hair. Like the brother, like hippie brother, has this mustache that connects to his sideburns that goes down to his chin, but there's nothing in between.
Yeah, and there's nothing on his chin.
So, it's this like, if you think of like a 70s stash burns kind of thing, it's a stash burn. That's what it is. And it's a very, very extreme example of that.
I know this was going to be a thing, and I know I've already said it. Now let me backtrack just a little bit. I don't like the hippie characters. I don't like the hippie characters, not because I don't like hippies. I don't like hippies. But I think it's more on the lines of I'm not a fan of how hippie characters are used in movies. Because this is supposed to be like a luxury like cruise liner.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just picking up just these hippies at New Jersey who just want a ride. And instead of like flying or trying to do something a bit more direct, they're just like, yeah, you can totally join us and just play music and eat our food. And we'll give you free room and board for all of this because hippies, hooray.
It just makes me wonder who was supposed to play the New Year's Eve party before the hippies arrived.
Yeah, like who was supposed to do this job that was obviously needed for the event that was on the boat in the middle of the ocean that you can't just get extra people on? So I am confusion.
It is the most like we could have almost done without having a drummer in the band. Like, he's doing almost nothing. He's playing very, very soft, and he's only using, like, two parts of the drum kit, and then one time he goes, like, over and hits a cymbal on the other side. It's like, okay, so there's a little... You can hit the other parts, you just mostly don't, and you hit the ones you hit real soft.
And I'm not trying to hate on people who have age differences, but I don't like the fact that all of the hippie friends die, except for the girl. And then, like, they just take her, and then they take the lonely, old, middle-aged man, or he looks way older than I guess he's supposed to be. And they're like, okay, these two characters are supposed to, you know, be linked together because they're going to help each other. I thought that was a bit unnecessary because she has no depth to her. We just know that she's a hippie, and she's part of a band, and she lost her brother, and she can't swim. And then she gives up very easily. Like, that's about it. We don't really know anything past that. And that's just because these are things that happen in the movie as it progresses.
He would have, Red Buttons, who plays that character, would have been 53 at the time. So I'm not sure how old his character is supposed to be.
Yeah.
Do you feel like it's creepy or?
I don't think I wouldn't say creepy, just odd.
Well, like, because he's odd to start with, that then him being awkward trying to talk to her is like extra awkward and edges into almost being weird and creepy.
See, I think it'd be okay if it wasn't for the pseudo dick joke. Like him having to explain the pills. Like, I think that scene kind of hurts portions of the story that's being told.
Do you think that's them trying to be edgy? This is just like, this is what early 70s edgy looks like in a family setting.
That's a good point.
It's like, we already have the first Dirty Harry movie by now. So the grittiness of the 70s was already here. But this is not one of those movies. And so I don't know if they're like, We're gonna slip this in, yeah. Well, because there's that. There's the she used to be a hooker thing. There does seem to be like, let's be ever so slightly and totally milquetoasty and mild and family friendly, kind of almost dirty. And
your kids won't understand, but by God, you will.
Yeah, because they...
I do like stuff like that, though.
I guess, but... Like, I mean, the whole pill scene is just sort of for not very much.
Yeah, like, why are you taking him at the dinner table?
I mean, I guess it's time.
He's just whipping out the whole bag.
He does.
Like, for a second, I thought it was going to be, like, drugs or something. Like, I guess technically they are. <They're>... like...
Well, no. They're not drugs because they're not approved by the Food and Drug Administration. They're dietary supplements.
Yeah. Herbal, all organic. Good for the planet.
Probably not organic.
Yeah, probably not.
A little too early in the 70s.
But then her name is Nani. And God help me. for all the bloody internet. And that's all I could think of was Fist of the North Star and then waiting for someone's head to explode. I'm ruined. Oh, I had something else too. Nope, already covered that.
It is interesting to go all the way back to the beginning, how this is, like, they frame it in such a way that it's the opposite of the Titanic. Like, the Titanic was, it's a brand new ship, it's a maiden voyage, it's big and fancy pants, and this is, it's an old ship, we're gonna scrap it as soon as we get there. And they use, like, Titanic-type elements that are all just total misdirections. They don't mean anything. They're like, we don't have enough ballast, which doesn't seem to matter because the wave that big, you're gonna flip over anyway. We're gonna go full speed, and you think, oh, they went full speed, and they wrecked in the iceberg, but then they're not going full speed when it happens, and it wouldn't have mattered anyway. And the guy's like angry and in charge and telling the captain to make bad decisions, but it doesn't matter because everybody on the bridge dies right away. None of the decisions that they made had anything to do with the disaster. It was an earthquake. No one had any control over. It was a wave too big to survive.
Yeah.
And so all of that is for nothing. It's just like, ah, it's going to be this. It's going to be that. And then it's not. It doesn't mean anything at all. So it's all misdirection.
Well, even with the misdirection, I feel like there would be a little bit more you could use afterwards. Like, what if for some great harrowing reason the captain actually didn't die? You know, like, just for some reason, like, come up with something, and so we can have more Leslie Nielsen. You know, just something. Because, oh yeah, I own the company that does the ship stuff, and I can have you replaced. Like, well, we can also lose you at sea.
Well, not even just that, but having...
Hey, kid.
He's like, well, there's, like, what, four other officers that have their master's license or something, but all of them should make exactly the same decision, and you're going to run out of officers pretty quick.
Yeah.
So if all of them are competent enough to have their shipmaster's license, then they should all say exactly the same thing Leslie Nielsen does, and we still do it by the book and screw your $30,000 or whatever it is to keep the wrecking crew on standby.
It's not $30,000. It's $3,000.
Was it $3,000?
It was a very low number. It was low enough that it caught my attention. I was just like, wow, even in the 70s, that seems a bit low.
Well, it's low to do that much screaming over and bad decision making over.
Like, bro, like, maybe $10,000, but everybody will be there safely. Or not. But okay, let's pretend like I'm one of the four other people with their masters. And they pull him. Like, I'll just lie to the dude, be like, alright, full steam ahead. And then when he walks off deck, be like, yeah, go back to normal. Like, let's get this schmuck off the board, you know? Like, we gotta not be stupid.
Well, he might notice that they're not going very fast if he looks out a window or something.
I don't think he has that level of competency.
I mean, it seems like not, because he's making bad sailing decisions. Even like the pump is busted. Like, that's for nothing too, because they start off in a storm, which is a really clever thing too, because they made no secret in the advertising and even like on the poster and everything about what was going to happen in the movie. The ship is going to wreck. It's going to be upside down. You know, the tagline on the poster is "Hell upside down," and then goes on to have much too much text on it and says, "At midnight on New Year's Eve, the SS Poseidon was struck by a 90-foot tidal wave and capsized. Who will survive in one of the greatest escape adventures ever?" And then the actual logo with the text in it is a white silhouette of the ship upside down with a water line going through the middle of it against black. And so it's like, we know what's happening. It's going to be water. The ship's going to wreck. It's going to be upside down. They're going to have to survive. There's like water flooding into the upside down ballroom on the art in between the much too much text. And then they start us off in a storm and the pump is wrecked and they don't have enough ballast. And then that's not what happens, because then there's just a time skip to the next morning and the storm's gone and sun is fine.
Yeah.
And so then it's not until later, and then they're like, oh, it's the earthquake. and then they're checking it out over the radio and stuff. And so they misdirect us right away because we think we're going to get the ship to wreck right away. It's going to be the storm for all these reasons. It's not.
No. Now, speaking of the next morning, I want to know how much time actually passed. Because we know that everything kind of happens at midnight because that's whenever everything's going off and that's when the wave hits the boat. So the amount of time between midnight and then the sun being up is not a very short amount of time. Like, we're looking at least 7 hours for that amount of sunlight. I'd say maybe 6, depending on the area you're at. But that's a long time to get through that ship. And it feels like it happened.
Oh, the next morning. Like when they're rescued.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it feels like they've only been doing this maybe an hour or 2 hours. And it's like, no, like they've done this the whole rest of the night. And it's now morning and they should be exhausted and hungry. And they don't look so much exhausted from like the time spent as they just look like they've been running so fast that like all of this happened so quickly that's why they're tired. Not like it's been drug out for all of these hours.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's probably early morning. It doesn't look like it's full on day or anything, but it's a number of hours longer than it appears to take because, I mean, there's no way to tell. No one looks at clocks.
Well, no,
we can't see the outside.
Well, no, here's the thing is we know it starts at midnight.
Yeah, we know that, but that's what I mean. After that, we can't tell how long anything is from anything else. It seems like we're just following them along and we're seeing most of what happens to them.
Uh-huh.
But it can't
be.
15
minutes. It's been 18 minutes.
Yeah, like, which actually hasn't even.
Yeah.
Even that's compressed. That doesn't take 15 minutes in real time. Ridiculous ultimatums.
Yeah.
But see, then there again, they hit it again at the end. That, like, we know that the people in the dining room died. We saw them.
Yeah.
But then the people who went to the bow, they died too. And we know they do now because they asked the Coast Guard guys, did you save anyone else? Anyone from the bow, and they say no. So, like, they are the only ones who made it because they were the only ones that did it the right way. And so, it's none of the like, yeah, well, our way worked too. Like, you don't get any of that. It's, which is probably not really that positive in a message sort of way. Like, there's only one right way, and the other priest does hit him a little bit with that he's only preaching for the strong, and that he doesn't if you can't help yourself, then who helps those people? Which is not a very, you know, priest kind of way to think about things.
I kind of find it interesting because like he's an angry priest.
He is an angry priest,
and I can understand
they're sending him off to like Africa or something to get rid of him.
And like I can understand where he's coming from with a lot of his stuff, where it's like, the message is simply put, don't expect people to do for you. You should be doing yourself.
I think the story does in a way cut against that because it does take like everybody gets to contribute in some way.
Yeah.
And so they do for themselves, but they also do for each other.
Yeah.
And so that answers the other priest's question. What about the people who can't help themselves? And I don't think he ever learns that, but he also doesn't make it out. So that may be something deliberate. I don't know.
Well, see, even with that, I was more caught up on these are the people who, like at the start, like these are the people who wouldn't help themselves and now they're dead.
Mm-hmm. They wouldn't help themselves or anyone else.
Yeah.
They were just going to sit and wait for someone else to help them.
Exactly. And so they're the ones who died. So like they're the ones that the main message he was preaching was supposed to be about. But then it kind of contradicts itself whenever there's the second group of people who are trying to do something, but they still die anyways.
But they don't have information.
No.
Or they're ignoring information or something. Because they're still not really thinking through it. They're still thinking in an ordinary way as if the ship is right side up, and it's not. So they haven't really accepted their situation and assessed it properly. They're still they're not thinking with portals.
No. They're not thinking with portals.
The other thing also is that they cut against it in another way, because they get themselves most of the way saved. But then they're still just faced with an inch of steel that they can't do anything about. And it's only because the Coast Guard shows up that and is able to hear them beating on stuff that they're able to get saved. So even though they do for themselves, they still are also dependent on someone else to do at least a little bit, too, the last little bit.
Now, I don't like the old man going ham, beating the steel. Because you have the one and he's like just smacking it a few times, and then you just have that old man just going ham, just losing it. And I'm like, wait a second, guys, you got to think this through, because if you just make random clanking sounds, you're less likely to be like, it's less likely you're gonna focus on it because it's just the ship making sounds.
Yeah.
But if you can make sounds within like some type of pattern.
You have to make it sound like this. Yeah. This couldn't happen accidentally or naturally. Someone is doing this.
Yeah. And so like whenever they do the, you can hear like the other people pounding, like you want to match that.
Yeah. Which it's, then it's they like, don't do.
No, they don't do it. I'm like, but then no. Like you got to match it. You know, a ship's not going to do that.
No. But like the Coast Guard bangs, like I think it's like 5 or 6 times, like in an even manner. And then it's but then they just ham again, and they don't match the pattern. But then they get saved anyway. So
yeah,
they're looking right at that cutting torch too.
Right at it. Look, kids, it's the light of God. I'm blind because you're looking at a cutting torch. Stop it.
Both priests dead.
Dead. You don't want to be a priest in a disaster movie.
No. Well, I don't remember. Was there a priest in Towering Inferno? Can't remember. Seems like there might have been some kind of character like that.
I don't remember one.
But
at least not one that I guess was like a primary character who was also of the cloth in some form.
Yeah. Now, I think that does blow it out in a bigger way. There are several more primary characters. There are more groups of people doing things in different places than there are in this. This is really compressed into just a few characters, and they're all in one place. And they're actually traveling around, too, because they have to actually move.
Yeah.
Because you can't move a building.
Well, I would say this kind of story is a very linear told story because there isn't enough room to move around.
Yeah, there's only one direction to go, kind of. They just have to keep passing through the ship to get to the place that they want to be. Towering Inferno, they sort of like, they move around, they go outside the building and climb up this way and then come back down, and then like the fire department is, because that's the other thing, is there's actually like rescue being attempted that just isn't able to do anything. But so we spend time with the fire department sometimes too, and there's no external anything in this until the end. We're just down in the ship with them in a really confined way, which I guess that moment that where everybody destroys the elevator because everybody tries to crowd it.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of like everybody destroys the Christmas tree. So yeah. It's still like you have similar beats that
you could have still realigned the Christmas tree.
They could have put the Christmas tree back up.
They could have. But it fell down and they just gave up. And then they drowned because they couldn't swim or attempt floating until the water was high enough that they could
just climb up.
So they could have just climbed up.
Yeah.
Which is what I would have done.
Yeah. So how do we feel about stars?
I'm gonna give it 4 stars. It's not quite perfect. Like, I still prefer the Towering Inferno.
I do also.
But like, this is really good for how it's supposed to be told.
Well, and it's earlier. So we can kind of say, like, oh, well, you know, we look at that and then we made it better.
Yeah.
By the time we got to the Towering Inferno, you know, and also because that's Irwin Allen. He's like, I did this on a boat before. I kind of know how to, and we won't make quite the same mistakes if there were mistakes to have been made. I'm going to say 4 also. I do still prefer Towering Inferno, but it still does most of what you want it to do in mostly a non-frustrating way. And just like the production of it is so like all of the upside down sets and, you know, big stunts and basically putting all of the main cast in at least knee high water for the entirety of shooting. And like everybody is just rough.
Suffering from
by the end of it. The daughter, or the not the daughter. I guess she is a daughter of someone. We don't know where their parents are.
I guess they're headed to their parents.
But the sister, she says that she went through like 10 different pairs of those shorts because they kept shrinking over time from being in water so much. And so they kept having to, like, the wardrobe department kept having to switch them out for new pairs of shorts over the weeks of shooting.
What was the position of that guy who was supposed to, some think the captain run the ship, but it's actually
the purser.
Purser.
Yeah.
That's such a dumb name. That's why I keep forgetting it. Okay. So I was kind of thinking about how you would want to handle that kind of situation where you're wanting to convince people to go, but they won't because the purser is telling them that, you know, like, don't do this. And like the malicious part of me had a wonderful idea, just a wonderful idea, because the purser says they're in a pressurized room, so the water can't get in. And as I stand there on that platform, looking down at them, I'd get their attention. And I would let them know that we'll reach a part and I will depressurize it to flood this room. So if you don't want to die in this flooded room, you might want to start moving. Because at that point, you know, like, the purser's already given away the fact that it's pressurized. And because that's what he says, is it's a pressurized room, so it's not going to flood. You just got to make the threat that you're going to unpressurize it. And then people are going to panic and be like, how's he going to do it? Like, you're already gone, so you can't, you know, like, now they can't ask you anything. You're moving on. So they're going to panic, and they're like, but what if he really does? And then they start, you know, why should we listen to this guy who wants us to stay here when that guy up there says he's going to kill us if we don't move? And then they move.
I don't think you want them to move for that reason, though, because then they're still just panicky and stupid. Like, if they're going to come along, they need to not get everybody killed the next time there's a decision to be made and they're all stupid and panicky, because they're going to be like you want them to come along the way that the rest of them came along, because they see that this is what makes sense and they're able to think and reason through what's going on and not just like be emotional and be upset, but still deal enough to be useful.
Well, no, see, here's the thing is I know the purser is still going to stay. Because the purser,
well, he's going to stay.
Exactly,
but the people,
the purser is the problem. We just got to get the people away from the purser, because once they start showing up, and just be like, "Yeah, I was just screwing with y'all," because that dude's lying to you, you know. Because like once you have someone with that seed of doubt, where now they have to feel like they have to make the decision themselves, like that's when you just got to get them away from that bad influence. Like, yeah, maybe I'm not the nicest person ever, and I'm going to lie to you with some threats to get you to move. But see, now you're moving. And you're going to be safer with us. You know, talking somebody down whenever they're not a mass horde isn't as hard. When you have a mass horde, that's when it's difficult. And just getting a few extra people away from the purser, I think would have helped. Now, granted, that means there'd be more characters that we'd have to deal with in this movie, which might put a strain, especially with the whole,
I don't like you, Preacher Man.
Well, it makes him a less sympathetic character, though, because he's being manipulative and he's lying and he's threatening, even if it's not true. Which the book version of the character might have been more likely to do something like that. I haven't read the book, but supposedly almost every character in the book is like really, really flawed and really, really unlikable. And there, which is kind of
that this, kid ultra annoying.
I guess I don't know if the kid is annoying or what.
Keeps talking about his bottle cap collection. Like, kid, I don't care about your bottle cap collection.
But that was one of the things that Irwin Allen wanted to do in having it rewritten, which he didn't write on it, but he, because he was the producer, he was sort of in charge of it. The director was only there as a result of the studio, because the studio said, we don't want to make this movie, because they bought the book rights, or he bought the book rights, maybe. And then they authorized a budget for it, and then they said, actually, we're not going to make it. Because what had happened in the couple of years between was Fox in particular had made a bunch of big, or like two really big, expensive, large scale, lots of stars movies, and both of them had failed. But the thing was, both of those were like old style, big budget musicals. Paint Your Wagon was one of them, which is famously a gigantic failure of a movie. And they just totally looked past, and they thought, it's the 70s, movies are coming out, they're small and they're gritty and they're real, and people don't want to see like big movies anymore. Which was a ridiculous thing, but it's another thing, you know. It's the Pixar effect. The studios had made a bunch of bad animated movies for the last few years. Toy Story comes out, it's a big success. They look at it and they say, well, I guess people don't want to see traditional animation anymore. They only want to see computer animation. All of our other movies failed because they were traditional animation, and people don't care about that anymore. Totally ignoring that those were just not good movies.
Yeah, it's like those movies all suck.
And the type of animation was totally incidental to that. The stories weren't good. They weren't good. And so the big giant musicals, which it may be true or may have been true that people didn't want to see big giant huge budget musicals anymore, because maybe it just wasn't what was popular at the time. But that doesn't totally write off any big, expensive movie. It's a ridiculous thing to think. And really, even like the gritty movies were still big and expensive in a way, because there were lots of things that you had, they're not necessarily expensive, but still larger scale, taking place over wide areas. And in the first Dirty Harry movie, they did dirt cheap, but they're all over San Francisco. And there's lots going on in it. They're up on rooftops and sniping this over here, big crane shot out from the stadium while he puts his heel into a guy's bullet wound. And so they were still big in production, just in a different kind of way. And they just thought, well, no one's going to care. We're not going to put money into a big expensive movie, because people don't see big expensive movies. And so he went to some rich friends of his and got them to put up part of the money, like half the money, and then went to the studio and said, I've got half the money, just give me the other half of the money. And they said, well, we get to pick the director then. And so they picked this director. And so that was the only thing that he didn't really have anything to do with.
And it turned out pretty good.
Well, yeah, it turned out fine. I guess actually it is sort of in an ironic way, even though I hate saying anything is ironic, because I think people misuse it all the time.
Not fair to the word ironic.
This Ronald Namie. Namie? He had directed immediately previous to this, or one of the movies fairly before this, Scrooge, which was the big giant musical adaptation of A Christmas Carol in 1970. And he directed the last Judy Garland big musical in 1963. So they hired a big, expensive musical director to direct this thing that they didn't want to make because it was big and expensive and they didn't think people wanted to see, because the big, expensive musicals had just failed. And so I guess maybe they thought, well, if we're going to make a big movie, at least he's made a big movie before, even though people don't want to see big movies. But stupid studio being stupid. Now, they did, in 79, make a sequel called Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, which is not good. And I've only ever seen part of, but it's not good. And in this case, Irwin Allen actually did direct it. And it has Michael Caine in it. But
wow.
And it's the only one of the Irwin Allen big disaster movies not to get at least one Oscar nomination. Generally, they got multiple ones. This one, I think, got like 5, and Towering Inferno got a bunch. And it, but he, but it's like, it picks up like right after the like the
what?
It's like still, it's still sitting there, and like they've been rescued, and then like the new characters, Michael Caine shows up in a tugboat, and they're gonna salvage it, and then things happen, like they go in back inside the ship, and it keeps exploding, and they get trapped, and there's like gold coins supposedly to steal, and it's just a mess, and it's dumb, and no one cared. And
sounds like a mess,
and it was bad. So now something also interesting that's sort of a connection to something else that we did is that right after this came out, like the next year, Irwin Allen had proposed a sequel. I don't know how exactly it would have been a sequel, because I guess you'd have to have characters, because it's not like, this wasn't, I guess it's pre-Towering Inferno, so we didn't know how we were going to like franchise the Irwin Allen disaster movie, but he was going to make it in a sequel in some way, but it was going to be a bunch of people trapped in a collapsed train tunnel in Austria, which... we've had a tunnel trap disaster movie on the show before. We had Daylight with Stallone, which was many, many years after, but it wasn't based on the same thing, because I think that was actually based on that was like a spec script or something, wasn't it? I remember talking about it. But yeah, don't watch that. It's not good.
Well, what about the, I don't want to call it a remake, but I guess that's what it's supposed to be.
Well, it is a remake. The modernization. The one that's just called Poseidon. It's from the mid-2000s.
I actually went to the theaters to see that one. And
I didn't. I saw it later.
I thought it was okay.
I guess maybe it's okay, but well,
I'm not
going to
sit here and say, oh, it was the best thing ever. Well, like, no, there's no movie better than this one. Like, no, like, it was fun. Like, it's what I expected of this kind of movie, just modernized. So when they're talking about like, oh, this is the flash fires, like, yeah, okay, like they talked about that.
I remember there being, I can't remember at all what it is, but I remember something about it. Something happened that made me really angry and just like write the whole thing off. And I have no memory of what it was, but I remember the feeling of it. I guess I'll have to watch it again and see. But the other thing about it is watching this. And watching movies from this time, you know, we talk a lot about the production of these and the, you know, the models and the scale and all the like the ridiculous stuff that they did. I talked, a lot about the full scale building in the Towering Inferno episode. But you just don't have that layer on it when you have a modern version of it. And so there's something about just the 70s disaster movie where it was like the height of physical effects, the most that we were ever going to be able to do before we had computer effects. And, we've been doing it for several decades now. We knew how to make big effects, and they did. But you still couldn't, it was still really difficult. And there's something to having, we built the thing full size, and we did this, and we did that. That's not there. And I say all the time, I never mean any of this to take away from what people who do computer effects or computer graphics or any of that kind of thing. I don't want to take anything away from that, because I can't do it. It's difficult to do it. It's still it's still impressive when you have really good when you have really good computer graphics, but it's not like it's just a different kind of thing. Because you don't have to tilt the set with forklifts and have, you know, hundreds of people actually slide down anymore, because you can just like hang them from a wire in front of a green screen and there you did it, and someone else, you know, fixes it. And so there's just a different, there's an extraness about it being from this time that's missing sometimes when we tried to do it again. You know, Ben-Hur has the same problem. Even if it was just the dumbest decision anyone ever made in movies to remake Ben-Hur, but just like one of the things about Ben-Hur is that like almost all of those people in that chariot race could have died at any moment and almost did.
Yeah, as I say,
and
like,
you just
some
don't
of them
have that. Like they did that. they did the chariot race like for real, and it was dangerous. And that's probably not positive, but
no, it's totally positive.
But they're. But now you don't have that. It's not impressive. Like, oh, look, they did it as a chariot race. Fine. You know, it's just missing that, like, they almost died in order to put this on the screen for us to see. So, have you seen it? Did you see New Ben-Hur?
Yeah, I haven't seen the new one.
I haven't seen it. And I was like, why would he do that? Why would I spend the time to do that? I don't care about this. Why did you make this? Why? And the award for most unnecessary film of at least that year goes to. They're probably more unnecessary.
Money.
Beyond Poseidon Adventure. Unnecessary film. They're all over the place. Money.
So why did you make this? Money.
Yeah.
See, I've always wanted to
say
we
didn't make any money.
Yeah, no.
We did it to make money. Didn't make any money. Lost us a bunch of money.
I kind of want to just sit in one of those meetings where you have all of these executives and they're like talking about like projects, and like I just want to see if there's at least one person who goes, you know, this idea is kind of dumb. It's kind of dumb. They all just look at them and it's just like, yeah, I have a feeling this is just going to be a disaster. So I don't want to put my money into it because I'm not dumb. Yeah, totally a terrible idea. But we need to capitalize on the 19th Sharknado movie. Like, no, we've already made one that says the last Sharknado. Like, we can no longer capitalize on this. We killed it ourselves. Done. No more Poseidon movies.
No.
Unless we're going to do, like, an offshoot where you actually watch Poseidon, King of the Oceans.
Or an offshoot where it takes place in a train tunnel. Some indeterminate way.
Yeah, like there's just this giant ship in a tunnel.
They didn't know how to franchise in the 70s yet. It's fine. Although they didn't stop Speed, because they went the other way. And you're like, this time it's a ship. Because this time Rush Hour hits the water.
Now see, I do really like the robot chicken. I like robot chicken, just in general. But when they make fun of movies, most of the time they do a really good job. And when they did the one for Speed, like the bus has to stay at a certain speed, and it's just like, oh, well, that's good, because that's the speed limit of this area. And this is like, it shouldn't be hard. It's like, no, but you got to deal with traffic and all this other kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah, like how is maintaining a boat speed even an issue? It's not like there's going to be like,
it's, I mean, see, that's the thing. You think that, and that's exactly the problem with it. Because I mean, I think it's some kind of like computer control thing where it's on some kind of autopilot thing, and they can't, I don't know. I think the main thing is just like they can't steer. And so it's not that they're going to they're eventually going to run into land. If they can't stop it, because they can't steer and they also can't stop it. I feel like I may also be confusing part of the premise with part of the premise of Superman 3. Which one's the Richard Pryor one? 3?
I don't even remember at this point.
I think it is, because that's the computer's one, pretty sure. There's something like that. There's like a console on a ship, and it's a computer.
Well, like, if you want to make it interesting, there has to be like a thing connected to the boat. that shows you like your current speed and the speed that you need to be doing, and it like changes. So you have to constantly focus on driving the boat.
Oh, so you just have to match the speed all the time, but you never know what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that way, like that person at the wheel like has to focus, because like if it changes and they don't change with it, it's like, well, you messed up.
Yeah. You know who didn't mess up?
Keanu Reeves.
Because he said no to Speed 2.
I love you, Keanu Reeves.
Well, that's all I have to say about the Poseidon Adventure. We'll see you next time.
Later.
Death by
diabetes.
Heart attack.